Welcome to the middle of the air.
Hi, this is Ken Butcher. For this episode, I was able to interview North Carolina writer Mark DeCastrieck, and we had a live audience here at the Novels and Novelty Bookstore.
On the left is author Mark DeCastrieck, who we're here celebrating his new book, The Singularity Race, which I really, really loved.
Well, I liked it, too. I read that.
And then this is author Ken Butcher, who wrote The Middle of the Air and Dream of St. Ursula.
Ken Butcher's good, too.
And Ken's wife owns Kilwins, who that's where we get the chocolate from. So everybody gets the plugs. And so just help yourself to wine and chocolate. We're informal. And afterwards, then you can get your book signed and mingle and talk and just enjoy yourself. So I'll turn the floor over. Thank you guys for being
okay.
Here.
Thank you, Valerie.
Thank you. And I don't guess I really need to introduce this man much, but Mark was born here in Hendersonville, now lives in Charlotte. Spent some time in D.C. in between there, lots of time. He's been a TV producer, a playwright. He's written something like 16 books, including Barry and Barry series, Sam Blackbird series, Flatman series, some standalone stories, a couple books for young adults. He's an adjunct professor teaching a course called The American Mystery, which I think I would love to take. I think that sounds like a great book. But I got a million questions for Mark, and I know we're going to have leave some time for you all to ask questions, too. But I wanted to start out by just asking you about your latest, tell us about your latest book, Singularity Race.
Singularity Race is not one of my series book. Those of you that may be familiar with Sam Blackman and Barry and Barry. It grew out of two quotes that I heard. One was, and I'll read real quick because
sure.
The preface to the book. I fully realize most of you can read, so I don't do a whole lot of reading. But these were two quotes that caught my eye. One goes, "We have the opportunity in the decades ahead to make major strides in addressing the grand challenges of humanity. AI, artificial intelligence, will be the pivotal technology in achieving this progress." And that's attributed to Ray Kurzweil, the director of engineering for Google, that we're all familiar with. And then the second quote is, "The development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. Humans who are limited by slow biological evolution couldn't compete and would be superseded." And that's from Stephen Hawking, theoretical physicist. So in a story or in a book, it's driven by conflict. That's what hooks you into the story. You care for certain characters. You don't care for other characters. And so conflict can take a lot of forms. But I thought, here's a conflict of ideas that's pretty extreme on the spectrum from two of what I would argue are the great visionaries of our age, the engineering at Google and Stephen Hawking and his cosmological theories. So I thought, that's fair game to develop a story around. So I didn't have a story, but I thought I had a pivotal point of conflict. And so the Singularity Race is about that search for what the singularity is in terms of computer science, is when the computer and its software and its programs exceed the human cognitive ability, and it would be able to become self-aware. And then we've created something that we don't necessarily have control over anymore. And I took two premises after starting to read MIT Technology Review, which I had to do in small doses to stay awake. But fortunately, they made it pretty simple for a layman to read what they were saying. And one of the things that caught my I was the concept of deep learning, and deep learning is the research into how a computer can teach itself. And several years ago, there was a small company, tech company in London, that took a program that would teach a computer how to play Pong. Any of you remember Pong? You know, I think that was like
high tech stuff.
That was high tech stuff, and the little beep and a little ball going across, and you'd sit there, you know, fascinated for hours. Well, their project was to give the computer the rules and let the computer figure out how to play it in the most efficient and perfected way without any further help. And their program that they worked on was able to do that. And then Google and Ray Kurzweil and those folks bought that company, if my memory is correct, for about $6 billion. And so they are now, you know, using the model of the human brain, which makes sense if you want a cognitive device, using the model of how neurons are clustered and synapses are clustered to develop this computer. And Ken, I took two premises that I'm not saying they were original with me, but I didn't necessarily read them someplace else that I consciously remember. One was that if it's the human brain is very complex, and a lot of our thinking ability comes from the subconscious. And so if a artificial intelligence was going to work like a human brain, did there need to be some sort of component of it that was the subconscious? And I thought, you know, that is probably the seed, in my mind, of where our most creative ideas
I thought that
come
was
from.
A really interesting angle that you brought in on that.
Yeah. And so that's so that we would need to focus on that. And the second point was that this computer, this supercomputer that happens at the singularity, there would only be one of them because it would so quickly hack into not only the DNC, you know, not only the government emails, but every laptop, cell phone, every program, weapons system in the country. And so it was taking that and applying what the two quotes signified from the greatest things since sliced bread to the end of the world was to try to put it into a narrative structure that has a thriller with spies and danger and humanity, you know, in it.
Yeah, I was going to say this is sounding very intellectual, and there's intellectual stuff in it, but this is an action book too.
Right. No one's ever accused me of writing an intellectual book.
It's got a good intellectual basis to it, but don't think you're going to sit there and read a computer manual, because it doesn't take long for bullets to be flying in this book and people to be running around. And yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
So is the quotes that you mentioned, was that the kernel of the idea? Was that the very first thing that attracted you to this concept?
Yeah, I think so. And just that, you know, when somebody like Stephen Hawking, who I admire just from the courage of what he's done to even be alive today, battling his form of ALS, when he says something with such certitude, and in fact, there was something he said today that was that the human race probably has about 1,000 years to live if we don't get off the planet. Now, I don't know if he likes headlines, but, you know, given the way the shape our world's in today, he may be generous.
I'm thinking, wow, that's pretty good.
And he's pushing for things like interstellar travel and things like this for the species. So, you know, technology, we don't know whether technology is going to be our boon or our demise.
Right.
And I think that's what kind of made it fascinating, and that just kind of fit into those quotes kind of fit into that framework.
Let me ask you kind of a minor question. The one of the things I like little details in books, and one of the details was the buffalo herd. Were you thinking of that buffalo herd you can see off like Route 74?
I was.
I thought so. I knew exactly what this guy.
Do you want me to talk about setting for just a second?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because,
go for it.
I had this character, Rusty Mullins, who showed up in a book called The 13th Target, which was about a plot to destroy the Federal Reserve. And it wasn't a theme that fit in with Barry Clayton or Sam Blackman. And he solved that case, and that book was done. And then when I realized this has a bigger scope than, believe it or not, Asheville or Hendersonville in the theater
that it's
playing out. It is, I know, it's a bold statement. I'm going out on a limb here, that it needed to take place a lot in Washington, D.C.
Right.
But, you know, as a North Carolinian and always wanting to kind of bring things back to the world, I know that's why this kind of research lab, the secret research lab that plays a role in this book, I set up near Lake Lure, right, along that way. And I did that because I was able to go on a tour of the Facebook factory is probably not the right word. The facility. Thank you, Molly. There was this facility, and my wife and I were given a tour of it, and you know, wanted to see where what machine had my Facebook page on it. But it's like it's big as multi football size, and all these machines are going. And I asked the gentleman who was in charge of it, why did he come to North Carolina? And he said, two things. He said, the land was cheap and the electricity was plentiful and cheap. He said, because you have this huge grid of capacity for the textile mills, the furniture mills, all the things that have vanished from our economy. Now, the downside was they needed the electricity to run all these computer brains. They didn't need a lot of human people to come in. So the jobs were more construction jobs and things like that. But I thought, well, there's a logical reason then for why this tech industry, this tech race for the singularity would have a component in North Carolina, right, if I use that model of Facebook for the reason that you would locate such a facility here. And the buffalo are there.
The buffalo
and
are
I thought,
there.
You know, why not?
So let me take a step back. I diverge from things sometimes. I just noticed from your bio, you were a TV producer in D.C., news producer, during the time of the Watergate scandal. I can't resist asking you a little about that. I'm a kind of a Watergate junkie myself, followed every detail of what was going on there. What was that like?
Well, I worked in news, in television news, and it was a local story for us as well as a national story. And every morning when you got up and got your paper, you didn't know what the next chapter was going to be. I mean, you saw this high drama playing out, and I can remember being at we were at the ABC affiliate, and they were televising the hearings, and when Mr. I think it was Butterfield. I wouldn't say Butterworth, but that's the syrup. Mr. Butterfield announced that they had taped the conversations, and that, just how electrifying that
was. I remember that. You know, I was going to ask you, what is the most dramatic moment?
For me, it was, I actually wound up being the director at the White House on the grounds the night Nixon resigned.
Oh, wow.
And we were providing the pull feed, means the video that would be shared among the local stations, and the networks picked it up too. And with all the crowds clamoring and all that happening, that to me was the pinnacle of my involvement in that story, to kind of be there at that point. And you realize history was being made, and it was, a lot of people were, you know, happy that were anti-Nixon. It was really kind of sad that
it was
our country,
sad for everybody. Right. I mean, even if you weren't a Nixon fan, right, it was like you realized something really important was going on and really unprecedented.
Right.
What was the? I promise I'm not going to talk about Watergate all night.
But what did I know? And when did I know?
And what did you know? And when did you know? No. When did you first think? This is a real story here. This is not just some crazy thing I'm reading in the Washington Post.
I think it's when Senator Sam, you know, our guy, started grilling people, and when the guy's name escapes me now, the one who said there's a cancer on the presidency, John Dean. Started talking, that they were very calm and credible witnesses and weren't necessarily towing the party line. It was then like, what was in it for him, you know, and why would he say that? And because there were a lot of anti-Nixon people, just like we've seen that in our recent elections. People don't like a candidate, so everything that's negative gets blown up to huge situations. I think that happened in Watergate in the early days, but then it changed.
Then it changed to something more real. And what how about a travelogue kind of question? You spend some time in D.C. Mm-hmm. What's a place in D.C. for the folks that don't spend a lot of time there? What's a place that they don't know about that they should? really cool place to visit.
Well, from one of the newer museums, the American Indian Museum. If you haven't been there, we tend to forget about that. You know, though it's coming up on Thanksgiving when we all wonder how harmonious everything was for a day. That's a great museum, and it's not only from North America, but all the way down to the tip of South America. And being a food junkie, the cafeteria there. Have you been there?
I have.
The cafeteria is one of the highlights because they have all the native dishes for a lot of the Indian tribes, and you can get a cookbook as well. So
it's interesting you said that because I was going to say, yeah, that's one of the best places to eat. Uh-huh.
And it's reasonably affordable for a museum, and good for museum food.
It is. Yeah, I agree with you on that. So let me get back to writing and literature-related things like I'm supposed to be doing here. You had a quote on your website that I came across somewhere. It really grabbed my eye. The quote is, "In everything that can be called art, there is a quality of redemption." Raymond Chandler. I really thought that was cool. What's your thought on that?
The thing I liked about that quote, Raymond Chandler is known, most of you, or all of you are probably familiar with him, but he was out of that school of Dashiell Hammett and hard-boiled detective fiction, where instead of using their brains, like Hercule Poirot, they would use their fists and their guns. So it was a more violent presentation. And he wrote an essay about that, talking about that his detective had a moral code unto himself that may seem alien to somebody else, may even seem immoral. But that was kind of the Sam Spade detective, the Philip Marlowe detective. And they were not perfect men, but the things that they tried to accomplish, the things that they tried to make the world better, could be looked at in a positive sense. And I think that in everything that's called art should be, and this is what I'm interpreting him to say, in the effort of elevating humankind and teaching us how to be better people to one another. Right. And looking at things in a fresh way and a new way and in that sort of redemptive process. Mm. So I do like that quote.
I loved it. I hadn't heard it before.
And sometimes you go into a book and think you don't want to preach to people.
Right.
But there should be some kind of theme that comes out of the book. You know, for Sam Blackman, it's a guy who's an amputee who's trying to become whole again. For Barry Clayton, who's the funeral director in a small mountain town, he wanted to be a police officer. His dad got Alzheimer's. He had to sacrifice his career for family situation and loyalty. Mm-hmm. There are themes there. I think in this book the theme is no matter where the technology takes us, we cannot lose our core humanity and cede that to them because that would, whether we're still here or not, we would have lost our humanity.
Okay. So put on your professor hat now. And I'm going to ask you some general questions. I mean, I want you to describe this course, for one thing. But I know every good mystery and thriller needs a good detective, a villain, a victim. So what makes a good detective? What are the qualities of a good villain? And I mean an effective villain. I don't mean a... And what makes a good victim?
I think I'll start with a good victim. A good victim is someone that you care about, and whose life mattered. And so when that life was taken away, there's an impetus that justice be done. Some of the criticisms of the puzzle mysteries that I've read, when I call that, I don't mean to be derogatory, but some of those early British things were like, Colonel Mustard was killed in the library with a wrench, and you don't really, he is just a device to start a puzzle, a matching of wits between, and as opposed to a human being, a fully drawn character. So even if your character is dead in the first page of the book, somewhere during that book, I feel like the victim is someone that you come to care right, about and the right potential that he or she would have had. I think the villain needs to be complex. You are, in a mystery book, telling two stories. You're telling the story of the villain, which gets to motive for what happened, and you're telling the story of the detective as he uncovers it. So I think it's a Margaret Maron, if some of you are familiar with her, whose work I really like. It said, every villain should have some virtue, and every detective should have some vice, just to reinforce their humanity.
Right, right.
You have to be careful not to make your villain more interesting than your detective. You know, in right some ways, Moriarty is maybe someone we'd like to know more about than Sherlock Holmes. You
right,
know?
Right.
And so that's important. And for a detective, it's a certain relentlessness and going for the truth wherever that mm-hmm leads. Michael Connelly, who I really admire his work, has a quote I like, which is, it's not how the detective works on the case, it's how the case works on the detective.
Well, I like that.
And so that's part of what you see. And even in a series, I try to feel like at the end of each book, my detective has been changed to some degree
right
by what
right
he went through. You know, the
somebody
opposite of that.
Somebody
needs to change. Yeah. And usually if it's been important to the detective, something has changed about him.
Right.
There's the characters that, you know, for years, Mike Hammer's, Mickey Splaine's Mike Hammer, he kind of knew exactly where he was. He was kind of frozen in time. You don't know that he ever changed.
Right.
I like to think of the Hardy Boys that I read as a kid. You know, it had to take them 21 years to get through high school because of all the summer vacations that they had. They were always the same. And I think contemporary mysteries, readers want to go on the journey with the character they like, whether it's Louise Penny's characters or Michael Connelly's character or what, or even my character, try to make that into some sort of overarching
right
arc, even though you have all these hopefully stories that are self-contained
right
and interesting on their own.
I agree with you. I think people are looking for more complexity. So tell us about this course that you teach. Is it a writing course, or is it for people to sort of appreciate
mysteries? It's a hybrid course. It's not strictly creative writing, but you have creative exercises. I start with Poe. You know, there's a reason why the Edgar Awards are named the Edgar Awards, and Auguste Dupin, or however you pronounce it in the real French, who was the forerunner of Sherlock Holmes. So you can have the history of the American mystery and actually predate the golden age of British detective work, as wonderful as that is. We then move into a writer who's kind of been forgotten, but in the first half of the 20th century, she was one of the most popular writers writing, and that's Mary Roberts Rinehart.
Oh, yeah.
Who wrote Circular Staircase and The Bat and the Man in Sleeper 10 or something. And these were, in their day, the writing style was more modern, was closer to where we are today than where she was to Poe. And those books came out in the early 1900s, like 1908 and 1911. She was a she. In a place where it was predominantly best-selling authors were primarily men, she was very successful. And so it's trying to give the students the understanding of how the mystery novel is reflective of the society of its time.
Right.
And how we went from, like, 19th century puzzle kind of stuff and cerebral stuff into things like the senselessness that happened in World War I, Prohibition that criminalized half the population of the United States with the stroke of a pen signing that amendment, and the Wild West was settled, but the Wild West came into the cities,
right,
the bootleggers and the gangsters and those kinds of things, and that's what kind of gave rise to what we would call the hard-boiled stuff. And so we move it up. I try to move it up, and along the way, give them exercises, create a character, create an opening scene where you discover a body, or go come up right up to the point that you discover a body, and then figure out plot points, you know, how the pacing of the story should go. I think a lot of problems with mystery novels is not that they didn't have a good idea, but they didn't have a good structure
right
for communicating it to the to the reader. And so those are all things I try to have them learn for themselves is actually the best way to teach.
Sounds like a great course. So
I'll sign you up for it.
All right. Okay. So let me switch gears a little and ask you about your personal writing style, habits. First of all, I'm sure you have lots of ideas for stories. How do you recognize a really good one and are inspired to say, yeah, that's one I'm going to work on for the next several months and get a book going here?
Well, now with a couple of series going, I know my characters well enough, I think, to understand their world and what would disrupt it. And,
right.
For example, Barry Clayton, in a small town, a part-time deputy sheriff, I know that small-town Western North Carolina setting pretty well, and I'll think of what haven't we explored. In the last book I did with him was the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians that are a part of Western North Carolina, but I had never used before. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could say it was more intellectual than this, but what I did was I went to Google Cherokee Indian Band of Eastern North Carolina and got their tribal newspaper. And that night before, they had had a big fight at the tribal council about whether to build another casino
right.
or not. And they had to call off their election and all that stuff. And I thought, again, going back to conflict, there's an interesting point. We've got two viewpoints within the same tribe. Millions of dollars are mm-hmm. on the line. I don't know what the story is. I don't know what the plot is, but I want to play with that. And so some of it is, you can say you're either writing the story or you're discovering the story that was maybe there ready to be told.
Which does it feel like more to you?
When I really feel like I'm doing well, I'm discovering
right.
the story.
Right.
And things present themselves. You start looking at the world through parallax vision of what your life is like and then what your protagonist is going
right.
through at the same time.
Right.
And things happen in the news that when you're writing in a contemporary setting that you find ways to incorporate and that maybe actually help the plot and help the story.
Now, at this point in time, are there a number of books sort of in your head or in your notebook sort of waiting to in line written, or is it...
About two, yeah. Kind of thinking, what would the next story be for my series characters, unless it's disrupted by something like this artificial intelligence
right.
Concept that I thought I'd like to do something with that. When you're going to spend a year with a book, if you don't like the story and the research you have to do, you've made yourself miserable. So I like to find something I'm interested in because I'll be spending time.
You're going to spend a lot of time on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how about your writing habits? You write every day?
I try to. You know, I still work full-time. I work in film and video production,
okay.
so I write whenever I can. I always usually carry a little notepad with me in my pen so that I'm not claiming to write great things when I'm doing that, but if a doctor's late calling me for an appointment or you're behind and I've got this, I'm happy. You know, I've got something to do, and writing is really rewriting, so I think a lot of the first part is getting stuff down on the page that you can then go back to and reshape. I like to say it's creating the clay that then you can come back and shape into something that's a better looking image. And then I write on a computer program and also I'll write on my iPad. And sometimes I find just the fact of jumping the tool. If I'm kind of stuck or not doing too well on the computer, if I pick up a fountain pen and a piece of paper and start again, I don't know what the story is, but I do better. I write faster, and then I'll switch it back over. So it's a question of trying to always be thinking about the book and then looking for the opportunities to write it, and then at the end, hopefully, it all comes together and you've got a document that you can then really... with your editor, start to work on. I don't know if you had that as your question, but in the writing process, you can't leave out your editor because
right.
she who must be obeyed, there's a day of reckoning. And my editor has been great to work with all these years. She has told me on a couple occasions, you are not killing this person. I'm not letting you kill this person. And the very next book, it will be, you are killing this person. This person does not deserve to live. And I listen to her, you know, because there are sometimes some options at the end for a character. I listen to her judgment on that, and sometimes we fight, argue, creative tension, I guess is the way I would say. But I usually go with what she says, or she makes me justify what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And if I can, then she goes, that's fine.
Do you find it challenging, because I do, and I think a lot of writers do, sort of changing focus from the micro to the macro, from this is a good scene, even a good sentence, even a good word choice, to like, how's the whole book gelling and coming together?
Yes. I find it harder to move when I come to the end of a chapter to get momentum up to move in the next chapter, the next scene. Uh-huh. If the scene's moving along, you do pretty well.
Right.
That's why I'm about halfway through the manuscript I'm working on now. That's why I have to go back and read what I have written just to try to hold all the plot possibilities in my head, because some of them can get lost or you think you had a good idea. Some of the things are small things. I like to put a lot of humor in my books, if you're familiar with that. So if I've written something that made me laugh, you know, then I like that. I remember that more than that. So that's either a scene or an emotion, you know, if I felt like it did justice to the emotion of the scene. Those are the kind of small victories you get. Subplots can be other ways that you like that. I've had my editor tell me, that's an interesting subplot, but don't forget you're writing a mystery here. I can get off track, and so that's another good reason to have somebody with a cute eye help you along the way, so you don't wind off in the ditch, you know, or if something you think of, all right, I'll table that and save it for something else. The subplot may have more potential as a full plot.
Well, I got a lot more questions, but I realize our time's running here. I should open it up for questions from the audience here. Yes?
I have two, actually. One, it's not maybe they're not really questions, but the first one is, I read to finish the book when I was waiting for my friend to get, and I was like, I don't like the ending. And then when you talked about the Raymond Chandler quote, it suddenly made perfect sense. Because I could see Rusty Mullins as Philip Marlowe. That same kind of character who has that inner core, who knows what he wants to do, yes or no, but he knows how it has to be done. And he views the world from that point. And that helped me quite a bit when you said that. And I was wondering, have you read any of Ray Kurzweil's books? Because Brentwood makes me think of Ray Kurzweil, in a way.
Has she picked up her questions? Have the questions?
Yeah, I was watching the...
Because Kurzweil has this book about eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And the brain, mm-hmm. and how if you want to live forever, you can live forever by putting your brain into a computer. And I was thinking maybe Brentwood had that. Did you have that same kind of idea or not?
I didn't take it from reading the books by Kurzweil, because I haven't read them. I have seen some summaries of where he thinks things are going. And Brentwood is a kid, as you know from the book, who kind of grew up on science fiction as an escape from a tough childhood situation. And so it was some of those longings and some of those science fiction theories is what I used to kind of him do it.
I did appreciate you put Asimov in there and the robot creed, as we can't harm any humans. I like that part.
Right, and I grew up with that. Yeah, you know, that's some of the fun of going back to your childhood for that. Thank you.
Who else has a question?
Do you write linearly in a line, or do you write something at the beginning and then something reminds you and you might go three quarters of the way in and write something and then eventually catch up to it again?
Most of it is linear. There's a quote my daughter shared with me, was that usually the last chapter that's written in a book is the first chapter. Mm-hmm. When you get to the end, you have a better understanding yourself of what's going on. So there are pockets of things that I may be writing basically linear, hopefully have a fairly clear idea of where I'm going and what that climax revelation scene or sequence would be, but then find opportunities to come back and add things as you go. Some of it is that I like doing the research, but I don't over-research. I research enough to feel like I've got some solid basis under me to carry the story forward. And then I write things that I would like to be able to do that, you know, that could happen. And then I'll go back and see if they can. Mm-hmm. I'll check that. And if we can't, then I'll either change it or I'll come up with some way to explain why this is an exception. So people will hopefully at least go with me on that. Sometimes research, I think, can drag a story down. It looks like I'm showing off that I've read all these MIT articles when I didn't really read all that that many, and dropping jargon and things like that, you know. And so I think it's a question of blending the credibility of the plausibility of what's happened without overly stopping the story, because as Ken said, there's bullets flying, there should be tension and jeopardy involved, and it's not a scientific treatise on artificial intelligence.
It's a really fun book.
Have you had a character who fought you and said, I'm not going where you want to take me, and you went with it? Or do you let them...
No, because characters can take over. In the Barry Clayton books, there's a character that I had just as a family accessory, and that was Uncle Wayne. Mm-hmm. He's 75 years old, still works and helps out at the funeral home, and he's got his own set of ideas, and that was a character that was just there to carry out certain functions, because I just needed more people than one guy at the funeral home. And over that series, he's kind of become one of my favorite people. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, well, let's check in with Uncle Wayne. What's Uncle Wayne think about this? And so there are characters that have happened. Usually it's you've started because you need somebody to perform a function, and then you realize there's more that they can do, and they kind of exert their personality. And if they're that kind of person, then I think they're going to be interesting to the reader as well, if they've kind of captured... captured my interest in a way that I hadn't anticipated.
Okay. Yes, sir.
When you were doing your research, I'm just curious, talking to the artificial intelligence people and Google and all that, did you touch on creativity?
Part of that was why I wanted to have a component in my story about the importance of having an approach that developed a subconscious for the computer. I wouldn't know how to do that, but I was looking at the consequences of that if you have a subconscious, it usually thoughts that you're thinking don't manifest themselves until they've reached a certain maturation, in which they kind of come unbidden. And you know, I've been around writers or songwriters. I think one of the ones that kills me is Jimmy Buffett saying that he was on a plane from Texas and wrote Margaritaville in like 15 minutes and has probably made $15 billion off of that. I don't begrudge him. That's the kind of a thing where that something was in his mind and it kind of popped forward. So what I was trying to do and set up in this fictive story of a computer is that there would be some threshold where thoughts in the inner part of the computer, which we call Asimov, in tribute to Isaac Asimov, is processing things in a different way that then would be lifted out when they achieved a certain maturation of thought, so that the big brain then took it as an aha moment and did something with it. Now, whether that will have that kind of creativity, I was more interested in having a computer that would not be strictly what you said, a problem solver, programmed to have reach certain conclusions and using their algorithms and whatever to come to conclusions, but a computer that would come up with questions to ask that we don't even know enough to ask those questions. You know, would you give a computer a thing like, what is the universe? I mean, that's not telling it what to say or that you want a prescribed answer, but what is it, you know, and is it going to turn out to be that we're all part of a matrix kind of world, which more and more physicists are starting to think think that way, and I'm just waiting for someone to come in and reformat my drive. Getting answer to your question, the creative thing is at the core of what I'm trying to do with this computer, but I did not specifically go talk to people about how they would do that. I would think probably if they're really onto it, they wouldn't tell me.
That's one thing I like about your book. Is that any of your books, if you read them, and the information you put in there, you don't expect us to get it all from the book. And mm-hmm. See, I'm a person that's inquisitive, likes to look for things. And when I get that, like with this computer stuff, I started looking all about that again. And that's what I like about it. Even with Sam Blackman, which I adore those books, there's still stuff in there that you talk about the area. And I've lived here all my life. Mm-hmm. But I've got to go back and look and remember these things. Mm-hmm. That's what I do like about it.
Hopefully not all your life yet.
I like the humor, too.
Yeah. And I think that is important because it's kind of like if you're going to introduce something to someone, then I want them to be curious enough to take it and go read more about the mm-hmm. Cherokee and the Trail of Tears and all those things that happen. Read about Medicare fraud, things that have been themes in the book and backstories in the book, but not trying to wrap everything up as a definitive book.
You had a question, too?
I have two, if I may. Mm-hmm. One, you were talking about editors, and I guess in my mind, I always thought an editor was kind of like a proofreader at the end. Do you work with them throughout the process?
Here's what happens. I send them a proposal for a book. If it's a new Sam Blackman book, I'll send, here's what I'm thinking, here's the background of the story, here's where I would like it to go. And then I'll get feedback from them that says, all right, that sounds good. You know, we trust mm-hmm. you. Start off. After about 100 to 125 pages, I am supposed to send that to my editor so that she can determine whether I have really whacked out on her and if it's hopelessly off mm-hmm. the rails. And she'll look at that, and I'll write a kind of synopsis of where it's going. Mm-hmm. I don't outline. When you were talking about linear writing, I don't outline as much as I used to. But I do feel like it's helpful to at least come down and put some sort of future synopsis out mm-hmm. there just so I can fool myself into thinking I know where I'm headed with it. So I'll send her that, and then I'll get critique back. And then when I finish the first draft, we get it. And then that's when she will usually say, this holds together, this doesn't hold together. Sometimes a common thing is that the person who was the villain just wasn't in the book enough. I mean, you may have read books, and I've read some where I was really disappointed because the culprit showed up in like the last couple of chapters of the book, and was I supposed to have a chance to do that? And so she will kind of help guide me to say, I think you need to have this person show up either a little earlier or a little more frequently. It doesn't have to be much, and it doesn't have to slow the story down, but you need to do that. And so we'll work with that on the revising the whole manuscript, and then she takes it. Then it goes to a copy editor to do what you're talking about, mm-hmm. to go through and, you know, have you gone crazy with your adverbs, right. You know, have you got run-on sentences, mm-hmm. have you got antecedents that aren't making sense, stuff that you missed. Mm-hmm. I think, and I'm saying this only half facetiously, I think the hardest part about writing is proofing. You know, because there's stuff that your brain just fills in the words, and you've written something horrendous down there. It's like you type this whole thing on email with your thumbs, and I don't think I have ever had a book that's gone through me, gone through my editor, gone through the copy editor, gone through my review of the advanced reading copy, that something didn't slip through. And it's usually something really simple that I knew everybody's brain. It should have said, you know, it is heavier than lead, and it was heavier that mm-hmm. lead, and you read than because that's what it was supposed to be. And so that can be humbling.
I just told my English teacher, look at all the words I spelled right.
That's right. No,
that never worked, and it doesn't work in
my
books either.
My second question is, you know, we talked, I think, at least I got so involved in your books because I recognized the area, mm-hmm. and that really got me turned into all the books that you've written. And in your Sam Blackburn, you have characters that are law enforcement officers that are twins, And I noticed one time you referenced Sheriff Davis here, and he has a twin brother. And I was wondering.
He does?
I didn't know that.
You're in a world of trouble now.
Married to him.
You're married to the twin?
I'm married to the twin.
Oh, okay.
So I just wondered if that was your influence, but obviously it wasn't. It was a coincidence.
The only reason I did that is.
Not important anymore.
you've got so many scenes where the detective comes up to a police officer, you know, on the scene, and I thought, how do you make this different? And I thought, what if he was confused because he talked to him here and then he walked 10 feet and he talked to him again?
That was
just, you know, like a little device to try to.
I have a wonderful article from the Times News that his mother cut out. Where one, I can't remember which, was one arrested them and the other one drove them to the jail.
Is he in law enforcement? Are they both in law enforcement?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay. All right.
So it was a coincidence, obviously.
I've always portrayed those characters as wonderful people.
They are. Okay. Married. Great. Okay.
Okay. And don't tell them what kind of car you drive.
Well, okay. We should probably let you get a glass of wine and sign some books here. But before we go, I always ask people, how do your fans follow you? Facebook or?
Facebook, I'll get comments. I get my webpage.
And your webpage
has got
is
a,
what?
Kind of, it has a, it's a markdekastrick.com.
Okay.
There's not a whole lot of them out there, so I was lucky to get that one. And they will write me through those. Through those things.
Very good.
You can find it.
Yeah. Wow. If you can spell my name or even get close to spelling my name. You can find it. And I've had, you know, good conversations from people. I've had people, I think I mentioned this the last time I was here before. I had somebody, maybe he's in this room, but he said, doesn't anybody cuss in North Carolina? And I wrote him back. He said, it's too tame. He said, I went to page 82, and it was just too tame for me, and I just thought you'd like to know that. And so, you know, he gave me his email address, and I always write people back. I said, the cussing starts on page 83. Should have stayed. So I'll get people that'll call me to task for, some sort of error that I may have made or difference of opinion that they may have with what I've said.
Mark, you put a couple of videos on there, too, about the area. And I thought that would, if you follow your writing, that kind of helps for people that aren't from this area that would get to see some of it.
Yeah, it was fun for me to do both Sandburg area and stuff around Asheville as well. Because, in my mind, I grew up here, even though I went through the eighth grade. I only went through the eighth grade for 1 year. I just want that for the that I still like being able to reference places that people would appreciate. And I do get, especially with Sam Blackman and that first book, Blackman's Coffin, is the one that has sold the most. So many people say they really liked it because they had been here to the Biltmore Estate and Asheville Grove Park and all the Asheville places, or they wanted to come here after reading it. And so sense of place, I think, it really contributes to the story.
Where do you get some of your information on some of those places?
I try to go to them.
Kind of figured that
out. I try to write as accurately as I can. In the first 13th Target book, my wife's here and she can vouch for what an idiot I was. We come to the climax of that book and it's around the Vietnam Memorial. It's right on the edge of the mall. And I looked through Google Earth. I looked through something. It was something that I needed to know. I didn't have to have it, but for my own sake at the end of the book, there was a certain geographical feature that I needed to have there. So we got in the car in Charlotte and drove in the middle of the winter to D.C., and I said, I want to just come down here to the mall. I'd forgotten to bring a coat. It was like 30 degrees. And I got out, and lo and behold, divine intervention, what I needed was right where I hoped it would be for my story. I saw it. She came around the block. I got back in the car. We drove back to Charlotte. That was it for the day, you know. And it was like it wouldn't have mattered to the reader, but occasionally you'll find someone, and I'll get someone who said, this last week, somebody wrote me and said, I had fun reading your book because I followed all the locations on Google Earth.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, people take different things from your book. I'm going to end up here, Ken, because I'm talking more than
that's
you.
That's okay.
You
that's
to.
Good.
But I think the fun of reading a story is that I write a story, but then you create a story from what I wrote.
Right.
And you're going to take something different from it. That's why bookstores are so great, book clubs are so good. You can sit there with a good friend who said, that book was the slowest book I ever read. Oh, I just fell in love with that book and the characters. And you quote, it's not the same book because it was interpreted in two different ways. And that's kind of the fun about getting to meet and talk to readers, because I have had people tell me things that they saw in the books that I didn't intend to be there, but they were right. You know, they were right from where they were coming from and what their perspective was. They saw things in a very legitimate way that hadn't even occurred to
me. That means you're really drawing them into the story, I think. Right?
I would hope so. Yeah, our goal is to try to make people forget that they're reading. When you pick up the book intending to read for 20 minutes and you look up and 2 hours have gone.
Right.
Gone by.
Right.
That's the best compliment you can get.
Do you have a blog or other?
I have a blog that I tend to randomly. It's usually about writing things, but it's on the website as well.
It's a good website.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you, Mark, for being here, for writing. Thank you, Valerie. Thanks, everybody. Thanks again for listening. And thanks again to Mark DeCastrique and to the Novels and Novelty Bookstore. To hear other episodes or to subscribe to our podcast, visit our website at themiddleoftheair.com. Thanks, and see you next time.